Well, we have our two favorite super string theories, right? So what are our two favorite super string theories? We have our type 2A and type 2B theories. Now, but they have some, I mean, they look spectacular. They are consistent theories of quantum gravity. They do something spectacular, but they have still some problems because we want to use them to describe nature. So what are some of the problems? Well, the first obvious one is that they live in 10 dimensions. Okay, but we know how to do Kaluza-Klein compactifications and so on, so that shouldn't be such a problem. They have fermions, okay? That was a big deal about them. They don't have tachyons, so they look spectacular. Can you think about any other problems that we have to solve? How many supersymmetries do they have? How many supercharges? How many? 32 supercharges. How many do we need in four dimensions? Remember, that's what's good about talking about supercharges. It's just an invariant state. We can talk about any dimensions, and the number of supercharges is fine. 8 supercharges in 4 dimensions? Well, that's a little bit too much. From beyond the standard model, what do we believe has a good chance of being there?
Probably it's at none yesterday.
What's that?
Probably it's at zero yesterday.
Okay. Maybe during the first week of beyond the standard model. How many supercharges? Well, how many supersymmetries in 4 dimensions that we expect might have a good chance of being there at the LHC?
Zero.
I'm sorry.
Okay. For the purpose of this lecture, we will assume that we all love the minimal supersymmetric standard model, okay? Which has 4 supercharges, okay? That's definitely the thing that we'll see at the LHC, okay? For the purpose of this. And therefore, if we happen to find something, so that would be our target somehow, to get to 4 supercharges. That looks like a long way. From 32 supercharges to 4 supercharges, that looks like a long, long, long way. And that's why we'll have 2 hours today. So that actually matches perfectly the plan. Okay? But there was also something else. So our 32 supercharges, here is we said 32 supercharges, were telling us, oh, there is also something great about being the first lecture. The blackboards are all clean and nice. This is nice. So we found that they not only contain strings, we talked about that yesterday, they also contain very mysterious objects, which we didn't know what they were. So we decided to call them, at first, RP brains. Where in type 2A, we found that P had some value, some particular values, okay? And these were 0, 2, 4, and 6. And here we had minus 1, 1, 3, 5, and 7. Both theories had what we can call NSP brains, where P was 1 and 5. This one was precisely the object we started to study, which is called the fundamental string. Okay? And this was nothing but the magnetic dual to the fundamental string. So this was also something we expected to have. Okay? So this is fine. But what are all these guys here? What are all these mysterious new objects? Okay? So that's the other puzzle that we have to resolve. Why did I decide to call them RP brains? Do you remember? Why did they choose the name R? Well, there must be a hint from the fact that they chose these ones to be called NSP brains. Anyone? Yeah, very good. These ones came from the gauge fields that came from the NS sector, okay? But there were also some other gauge fields that came out of the RR sector. And these are the P brains that coupled to them. That's why I call them RP brains. Now, I left you yesterday with a puzzle, okay? Which is also the hint for the answer to this question. So the hint and the puzzle was the following. If we now take our 10-dimensional space-time and we compactify it and we write it, say, as flat space-time in 8 dimensions times a circle of radius r, and we take our type 2a theory on this space. Yesterday, we discussed that under t-duality, we will get type 2b on a space that is also compactifying a circle, but where the radius is the inverse of the radius that we have here. Of course, you should all complain about how about the dimensions, okay? But there are powers of alpha prime that take care of the dimensions, which I'm not writing, okay? I'm working in units where alpha prime is 1 or 1/2, some value, but it's a number. So in those units, r is dimensionless, okay? So this is the new radius here, r prime, say. Now the puzzle arises when I say, well, let me take type 2a, compactify on a circle, and take the circle very, very small and shrink it to zero size. Then what should I get? I should get type 2b string theory in 10 dimensions. But how can that be? Type 2a only has this kind of r brains, and type 2b has these kinds of brains. Okay? Did anybody find the resolution to the puzzle? Well, I gave you a hint yesterday, even another hint, which was that the right name for this object is not RP brains. People like to call them DP brains. Okay? Well, on this blackboard, let's review what we talked about when we first met the D brains, okay? Because I think at that time it was a little bit confusing how to think about the DP brains. Do you remember what the D stands for? What? Very good. So we said that open strings could have two kinds of boundary conditions, Neumann. And Dirichlet. Okay? So remember, a Neumann boundary condition tells you that the end of the string is free to do anything it likes along that coordinate. Okay? So if I have a Neumann boundary condition in the x1 direction, the end point of the string is free to move there. Okay? If I have a Dirichlet boundary condition on the x1 direction, it means that the end point of the string is nailed to some point in that particular direction. So the whole confusing thing, the whole thing becomes confusing when you start mixing conditions. Say, in the x1 direction, I have Dirichlet boundary condition, but in the x2 direction, I have Neumann. So how can I visualize that even in 10? Now when we go to 10 dimensions, it's even harder, right? Well, but let's start with a toy example. Let's imagine that our space-time is 1.3 dimensional, just for the next 10 minutes. We know, of course, it's not true, okay? let's just do that. And let's pretend that we will study a D1 brain in this space. Okay? Now, our D1 brain, the one that I like, is going to be a D1 brain, and we say that it's along some direction. Let's choose it to be along the X1 direction. What I mean by that is that my D1 brain is a one-dimensional object in a space, and it's going to be an infinite string extended along the x1 axis. Okay? So what are the boundary conditions for the open strings in this case? So let me draw the configuration. Again, I'm not drawing time. So the configuration is our string here, our D1 brain, stretch along here. So what do I need? Well, the D brain is defined in such a way that my open strings, the endpoints, will have to lie on the D brain. Otherwise, the string is free to do whatever it likes. Okay? So my points are free to move here. Okay? Along the word volume, or the word line in this case, of the D brain in a space. It's just a one-dimensional object. So instead of drawing pictures, people like to introduce the following notation. Okay? They like to make a little table with the space-time dimensions. Okay? The directions are time, x1, x2, x3. And then they like to put an x if the string has Neumann boundary conditions. And nothing if it has Dirichlet. Okay? Can anyone tell me what the endpoints of this string boundary conditions are in terms of this table? Where should I put x's? Very good. And what else? In time. Excellent. And I'm done. If you give this table to anybody who knows about deep brains, they will know exactly what to have in mind. Can anybody see? Can everybody see why Anton chose this to put the x's there? Well, let's see. We said x means Neumann. Neumann means that the endpoints of the string are free to move in that direction. Are they free to move in time? Yeah, they better move in time. Are they free to move in the x1 direction? Yes. Are they free to move in the x2 direction? No, they are locked to the origin in the x2 direction. So they must be Dirichlet. In the x3 direction, they are also locked to that place, right? At the origin. So they cannot move up, they cannot move in that direction, they can only move in this direction. Okay? Very good. Next example. Let's try a D0 brain. Where should I put the axis? Anyone? Very good. And that's it. So what would be the picture for a D0 brain? It's a point here in space, and my open strings will have to start and end at the point and do nothing else and oscillate. They can nicely oscillate. Okay? And the last example, let's say we have a D2 brain. Okay? And say that the D2 brain is extended in the X1 and X3 directions. So I'll have 0, 1, 2, 3. So now you can see that I'll have to put the x's here. Okay? And I'll leave you as an exercise to draw the picture, what it would look like. Okay? So now, armed with our new table, we can jump to 10 dimensions. And we don't have to draw anything. Well, not really, because we want to compactify on a circle. So it would be nice to have some picture in mind. Okay? I don't want to erase the puzzle, but let's do it. Yeah, I think I have it. Here. Okay. Last week, you studied what happened to a string if you compactify space-time. So let's compactify space-time on S1. Let's call this S1 direction. Let's pretend it's X9. Okay? So I'm going to draw here for you a cartoon of the X9 direction and, well, it's actually not a cartoon. It's correct. If I only draw X1 and X9, it's a cylinder, okay? I'm suppressing all the other directions. The other directions are just extended, and we have just flat space-time. So if we want, we can replace this by an R, okay? And what do we want to do? Well, imagine we are in type 2A, and we have our table with our 10 directions. Of course, this one is special. This one is the one compactifying a circle. And imagine the following configuration. I want to have a D2 brain of this form. Now everybody can imagine what that looks like. What that looks like, right? In fact, this D2 brain was designed in such a way that it corresponds to what? Can anyone tell me in the picture? If you think about the D2 brain as a membrane, as an infinite membrane, what it would correspond to in the picture? Well, look at the axis. This is the X9 direction. And this is the X1 direction, okay? So in fact, my membrane is a cylinder, okay? My D2 brain is a full cylinder. And that means that the open strings, the endpoints of the open strings, are free to do what? Are free to move. So my open string, the endpoints are free to move anywhere they like along the cylinder. Okay, because they have Neumann boundary conditions there. But last week, you studied what happens to the boundary conditions when you apply T-duality. What happened to the boundary conditions of these nice open strings floating around? They were Neumann boundary conditions. After T-duality, they became Dirichlet boundary conditions on X9. Okay? That means that there was a special point here on X9, a special location, and our points had to be stuck there. Okay? Of course, X9 is periodic. That's why you found that something that carries momentum here, a string that carries momentum here, will end up carrying winding in this space. So depending on the momentum that it carries here, our open string can actually go and wind around. So this is the open string. But now what happened? So in order to be consistent with this, a D brain, a D2 brain under T duality will have to do something interesting. What will happen? Well, it's going to lose an X, right? Remember, we're putting X's where the endpoints of the open string has Neumann boundary conditions. But this guy had Neumann boundary conditions along X9. Now it has Dirichlet. So what we are doing really is just deleting this x. So no x for x9. So under t-duality, what happened to our D2 brain? It went into, what would this be called? D1 brain. But this is great. This is actually in type 2B. We have D1 brains in type 2B. So this is spectacular. Okay? So these D brains, these objects, of course, what I'm telling you are consistency conditions. In order to interpret these guys as objects where open strings can end. So what we're doing is seeing what the behavior of the open strings is and inferring from that what the behavior of the D brains is under T duality. So what we are discovering is that for the whole picture to be consistent, the D2 brain under T duality will go, of course, the D2 brain in these directions under T duality will go into a D1 brain. Okay? Why did I have to be careful about a D2 brain in those directions? Well, the reason is the following. Imagine that we do something else. Let's take our same D2 brain, but let's now put it here. Okay? So now it has Dirichlet boundary conditions in X9. So under T duality, what's going to happen to those boundary conditions? They are going to go to Neumann. So what do I have to do? The game is very simple. T duality, if there was an X, you delete the X. If there wasn't an X, you put an X. Remember, only along the direction that you're doing t-duality. So what did we get? A D3 brain. But that's also part of the type 2B set of D brains. Okay? So, believe it or not, just a game like this, a simple game like this is something that gave a lot of hints for the discovery of deep brains and what they are. Of course, the whole story is much more complicated and as it should be, because you want to really prove that these guys are the ones that carry a charge under the Ramon-Ramon fields that you have here. But we will not do that. We don't need to do that. I mean, all we wanted to gain was intuition on what these objects were doing, and in fact, that these strange objects appear in our physical string theories, okay? Now, this is funny because we said that type 2A and type 2B were closed string theories, but now you see that they could also have open strings, but the open strings are confined, the endpoints are confined to live on the new extended objects we found, which are these D brains. Any questions? Well, yes. Well, I'm studying my theory in this space, and I chose, it was my choice, to compactify X9 on a circle. You could choose any other one. In fact, I encourage you to start playing and say, well, what if we compactify on two circles, X9 and X7, and then you do t-duality on one and then t-duality on the other one, what is supposed to happen? When you do t-duality once from type 2A, you go to type 2B, and if you do t-duality on the other direction, you will go back to type 2A. But then the D-brains will do crazy things, right? A particular D brain in some direction after T dualities, many T dualities will end up being a completely different animal in another in the new space. Even in the original theory, it will end up in the same theory after two T dualities, but being a completely different object. That's something that people have used many, many times as tricks for understanding, say, even black hole physics, where you have some configuration of brains, D5 brains and D1 brains, And then you say, well, this doesn't look like something I can understand very easily. And then they do t-dualities to map that into something where they can do it more easily. Okay? So playing with this is something that has been very useful. Yes?
I like the fact that the brains are in that way, show you that you have open strings.
Sorry? Can you say that again?
I see that you have open strings from that picture because you started with the picture with open strings and you ended with the picture with open strings.
No, I'm assuming, so what I'm assuming is that here all I'm doing is studying what the brains are, and the definition we made 2 weeks ago was that they were some mysterious objects where an open string could actually couple to them only through the endpoints and stay coupled to that, right? So we made that definition just out of the blue. We didn't give any more evidence or reasons to believe that they exist. Now what I'm saying is that that definition of that object matches perfectly what we need for t-duality to work in type 2A and type 2B. And for these objects to be identified with the Ramon-Ramon charge carriers. Okay? And I also just told you that I'm not going to prove to you that they are. I only gave you evidence that they are consistent with that picture. And I'm going to declare now that they are. Okay? Very good. But how can it be that these guys, how can it be that these open strings end up attached to these objects? Why would they want to stay like that? Okay? So that's a question we could ask. And a reason for that could be the following. From the point of view of the word volume, of the deep brain, imagine this is a deep brain. Again, we're not drawing time. Okay? So from the point of view of the word volume, what are these points? What do they look like? The end points of the string. So if you were somebody living on that, well, in fact, we could be. Imagine we were doing a D3 brain, say. The word volume of that D3 brain living in 10 dimensions would be a 3 plus 1 dimensional space. And any of us could be living there. Okay? So we would be happily living in our D3 brain. And from our point of view of somebody living here, the endpoints of the string would look like what? They would look like particles, okay? Now, for these particles to actually stay there and be happily living there, it better be that they have some charge, okay? The only way we know how to make things stable and not disappear or decay is if they have some charge, okay? If they have some conserved charge, you cannot just make them disappear unless you pair up two guys with different charges. Okay, with equal and opposite charges, like an electron and a positron. Okay, so there must be some charge. So that's why people found out that there would have to be a U1 gauge field on the word volume. Of any B brain, there would have to be a U1 gauge field. Now, these guys end up being, so the end points of the string will be charged particles. Now, our open strings, they have an orientation. We can go from 0 to pi, okay? And the states are defined in such a way that we know the orientation. Okay? So that means that we can meaningfully talk about the starting point of the string, say at 0, and the end point of the string. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because you can imagine the following. Imagine you have your deep brain, and these two points start to get very close to each other. Okay. So this is a picture. These are different pictures of the same vibrain and things happening at different times. So this is at t equals 1. This is like in high school. At t equals 1, at t equals 2, and at t equals 3. The two points get together. And at t equals 4, guess what happens? That's right. It pops out. You produce, the deep brain emits a closed stream, which is fine. We are dealing with deep brains in type 2A or type 2B theory, where we have closed strings in the bulk. Okay, so the closed strings in the bulk are living happily there. When they come and collide with a deep brain, they can actually open up and live there as open strings, or the open strings can combine and be emitted as closed strings. Okay, so that means that our deep brains actually do what they should be doing, which is to radiate gravitational radiation. Okay? So our deep brains actually gravitate. But that's not what I want to do with this. It's just to tell you that if these two guys disappear, what should the charges be of the endpoints of the string if I'm allowed to disappear, to take them away? They should be opposite. Okay. So let's say that this guy has charge plus 1 and this guy has charge minus 1. Okay, that picture looks very good. Now let's complicate life a little bit. How can we complicate the picture a little bit? Consider 2. Two deep brains. Say two V3 brains, if you like V for any reason. Two parallel deep brains. Okay? You have your two parallel deep brains. Very good.
So yes. I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I like exactly. Why do we know? I mean, you know, like this picture looks nice and everything, but why does the string, you know, why can it switch boundary conditions when its endpoints meet?
Well,
and why would the endpoints be?
Well, you know that if you have a theory that is general Cobanian, anything should couple to gravity, right? That is one of the principles of general relativity, right? So these deep brains, if they are theories, if they are objects in our quantum gravity theories, okay, type 2A or type 2B, they better interact with gravitons. And we know that the gravitons are only there in the closed string sector. Okay? So if we are pretending that they have a nice description only in terms of the excitations that are produced by open strings ending on them, there must be a process that allows the production of closed strings and the absorption of closed strings. So this is the process. Of course, this is just a picture. You have to work much, much harder to actually prove that these things are true. Okay?
Where did gravity come in here?
Well, who has gravity in the spectrum? Closed strings or open strings? Don't remember?
No.
Anybody? Closed strings have gravity in the spectrum, right? Very good. Open strings don't have gravity in the spectrum, at least not in the spectrum that we found. We know that in loop, when we did that picture, that if you have open strings and you look at loop diagrams, then you can actually think about a loop diagram developing a closed string channel. But that only tells you that, well, open strings and closed strings must be together somehow. Now we have a theory of gravity, which is general covariant. So anything that lives there should couple to gravity. Couple to gravity means it should gravitate, it should feel the effect of gravity, and it should also produce gravitational radiation. Now, the other assumption we're making is that these deep brains are described by the physics of open strings ending on them. So we have to model the two processes. So if you run the picture in this direction, you are emitting a graviton. So this guy actually emits gravitational radiation. Now, run the picture in the opposite direction, and you will see how this guy feels the effect of gravitons by eating up or by absorbing a closed string into open strings. Okay? Yes?
Why should we assume that if we have a closed string, it remains a closed string? Like, why wouldn't it shrink to a point, for example?
Because there is a conserved charge. Is charge under which field? No, the closed string. No, no, you're talking about the closed string in living in the bulk, right? So what is the conserved charge? Which field is sourcing the closed strings? You remember we said when we discussed the brains, we talked about the NSP brains, and we said P equals 1 was our fundamental string. But what is the NS 2 form? It's the B field. Do you remember? There was a B field. In the closed string spectrum, we had a dilaton, the B field, and the graviton, right, and the metric. The fundamental string carries a charge under the B field. That's why it's stable. So that's a very important point. So we are all stressing the point that if there is, you at all times you must ask, why is this object stable? Why it doesn't disappear? Okay. And always the answer in string theory happens to be that it's stable if there is a conserved charge that this guy carries. Okay? Yes?
So the closed string lives in the bulk, right?
The closed string lives in the bulk.
But it's vibrational spectrum if you grab it.
Yes.
So how does the
if you have some other object that is emitting gravitational waves or even any classical background is just a coherent state of gravitons, right? That's the usual way you go from excitations to a microscopic field, right? You would say, well, the electric field when I put two big electrodes. And I say that there is an electric field, and I put an electron there, and it fills the electric field. How is that electric field made out of photons? It should be, right? We say that QED is only made out of photons and electrons, so there is nothing else. So that macroscopic field that this electron fills is made out of photons, but it's a coherent state, okay? So likewise, gravitational waves are made out of gravitons, okay? So all we have to know in principle, is that our object is able to interact with gravitons. Okay? Yes?
So these are
antiparticles.
These are? The two ends of the string are part of an antiparticle, right?
Yes, that's right.
Does that mean that in the entire universe you have the same number of particles and antiparticles?
No, it doesn't mean that. I haven't told you that this is the universe. Yes.
So the gravitons come from the spectrum of closed strings.
Yeah.
The things inside world poly don't have gravity?
No.
So it's not our world.
So actually some people like to say that this brain, right? Yeah. Some people believe that, in fact, this brain, once you take into account the effect of gravity in the bulk, it will have an induced metric. Okay? And that induced metric will make you believe that there is gravity in that brain. And in fact, the fact that the gravity lives in more dimensions than the dimensions you experience explains spectacularly well why gravity is so weak compared to the other forces. The other forces live on the brain, while gravity is diluted in more space. So that solves in one shot the hierarchy problem of why gravity, the problem of why gravity is so weak compared to all the other scales. Okay? So while people were making, while people were, I mean, people realized that later on, but in string theory, this idea that actually this hierarchy of scales was completely natural was already there from the beginning. And probably you studied that last week, right? Oh, if you are taking the beyond the standard model course, that is. Yes.
There were two separate strings attached to this brain, and two ends of that string, say, annihilated on each other. Would there be a non-local effect at the other two ends?
Well, it depends. It depends on the charges. If they can, then they can connect and go away, right? So you can have another one here. They can connect and become a bigger one. Yes?
So if it's electrically charged fermions, can those two points be electrically charged fermions?
Yeah, so remember, these are superstrings. Okay. There is a full supermultiplet. When I talk about U1, I mean a U1 supermultiplet, and there are these particles are super particles. They contain bosons and fermions. Okay, but if you thought that this was confusing, or interesting, I hope, instead of confusing, let's see what happens when you put two deep brains. Okay. If you have two of them, of course we can have the strings that do this. Well, maybe the other thing I have to say is that, I mean, it's too much to pretend that in just 3 weeks we can cover in full detail something that has been developed by dozens of people in 20 years, okay? And people working like crazy day and night. So it's really, really, really a long, long story. So all I can do is to give you a glimpse. And if you think that there is something interesting, we can discuss it further. But moreover, you should try to study more of these topics. I think that Polchinski's book is actually great for many of the purposes here. If you want to learn about more modern material, then you will have to read the Becker's book. But of course, there is always a classic, Green-Schwarz-Witten, for the almost anything that is not done carefully in the first two books, they refer to Green-Schwarz and Witten. So you will definitely have to go there at some point. But let's go back to our topic here. We have the 2D brains. We have these open strings moving around, but nobody stops us from having open strings that go from one to the other. They can go in that direction or they can go in this direction. Now, on each D-brain, we just argue that there had to be a U1 gauge field. Now, from the point of view of this D-brain, there are particles that carry this U1 charge. And they also seem to carry this strange flavor symmetry. Okay? From the point of view of this guy, the U1 gauge field, or the U1 gauge theory here, looks like a flavor symmetry. Doesn't look like a gauge symmetry. Okay? And from the point of view of this one would say, no, my U1 is the gauge field, yours is a flavor symmetry. Okay? So this guy thinks that this one is a flavor, but his or hers is a U1. Okay, but there is a way to make everybody happy. And what's that way? Well, imagine that the separation, we call the separation of the D brains L. One can compute the mass of these open strings stretched from here to here. It's not hard to imagine that the mass would be proportional to the length. Okay, so there are these states, charge, like this, under these U1s. Okay, and these states are massive, and their mass goes like the length that separates the 2D brains. Now these guys, if you look at them from the point of view of this U1, they look like massive charged vector bosons. Have you ever seen massive charged vector bosons anywhere?
Yeah.
Excellent. So this guy, from the point of view of this guy, looks like W Boston. And what happens when the mass goes to zero? The symmetry is enhanced, right? So you would expect that when you take L to zero, let's take L to zero. So you put the two D brains on top of each other. Now you have the states you had here, okay? The ones that were originally on this D brain, the ones that you had originally on this D brain, and you have two new massless states. So in total, you have four massless vector bosons. Well, if you look at the charges, it's not difficult to guess that these four massless vector bosons are precisely the ones that you get or that you need to produce a U2 gauge symmetry on the world volume of these deep rays. Now, how can you convince yourself that this is the right object? Well, imagine doing precisely the opposite. Imagine separating the rays, okay, and seeing what happens to the states. Now, you would say, well, this looks a little bit strange, but you might recognize this picture if you do it. Imagine we have n of them. So D brain 1, D brain 2, 3, and we have n of them. According to this, I would claim, what I would like to claim, that if I put them all together, I get a UN gauge theory on the world volume of the brains. Okay? That's what I would like to claim. So when they are on top of each other, my U1 to the N groups become a UN gauge theory on the world volume. Okay? So the picture that I want you to keep in mind is the following. Imagine brains that go, open strings that go from here, these ones that go from here to here, the ones that go from the N-1 brain to the N, but there are also guys that go all the way from here to here, and things that go from here to the N and so on. There are the guys that go like this, there are the guys that go like this, and also opposite directions here. Here is a tricky question. Does this picture remind you of anything? You really have to have a very twisted mind to, what? Yeah, that. But something we have done in this course, a picture we drew in this course. It doesn't quite look like that, but it topologically looks the same. Especially if you turn the deep brains into little circles. Into what? Yeah, it wasn't the representation. What was the name? The Dinkin Dagger. Looks like the Dinkin Dagger. Somehow, the states that are sitting on each of the D brains furnish for you the U1s that are in the Cartan subalgebra. Okay? Now, the guys that go from this guy to the next one, okay? Well, first of all, the guys that go in that direction, we can declare them to be the positive roots. Okay? The guys that go in that direction, we can say they are the negative roots. Now, remember, in the positive roots, we also said that there was a special set of them. Do you remember what they were? Within the set of positive roots, there were?
The simple
roots. Those were the roots that could not be made out of the sum of two other positive roots, right? So what would be the simple roots? Well, this guy would be a simple root. This would be another simple root. This one would not be a simple root because it's made out of the sum of these two. Okay? So these are the simple roots. And that's precisely how you can see that these guys, these states, when you squeeze them, they precisely give rise to a UN gauge symmetry. Moreover, there are fascinating relationships between deep brains and when you put them in spaces with singularities that allow you to generate any simple lace gauge group. Well, did I mention what a simple lace gauge group was? Was one where are all the algebras with a linking diagram that only has single lines, okay? In other words, G2 is not simple lace. SO5 is not simple lace. Okay. Well, in any case, yeah, I shouldn't get excited about that. Let's just leave it up to that. Okay. So this was only to tell you that this is what you would get if you have D3 brains, and D3 brains, you will get a UN gauge theory that has, it turns out, four supersymmetries in four dimensions, right? A D3 brain has a Bohr volume which is four-dimensional, so you'll have four supersymmetries in four dimensions. And why four supersymmetries? Well, because the original theory was type 2B, it has 32 supercharges, okay? But this guy inside doesn't have gravity. So it cannot have 32 supercharges. Remember, 32 supercharges in four dimensions was enough to take any representation, any helicity state, and boost it all the way to contain a helicity 2 state. Do you remember the game we played with the supercharges? If you have 32 supercharges, there is no way you can escape a graviton. And I just told you that these guys don't have it. So you better not have 32 supercharges. So you reduce the number of supersymmetries by half, and you only have 16 supercharges. And that's why you have n equals 4 superjambians in four dimensions. And this is what you're going to use for the ADS-CFT duality. Okay? This is the way n equals 4 superjambians with gauge group UN will appear in the story. Okay? But once again, this is so important that I'm not going to say anything more about it. Yes.
When you give off that graviton, when the two particles annihilate.
Sorry. When?
When the two particles annihilate and the string flies off, does the D brain recoil or anything like that?
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. There is a whole story about back reaction. Yeah. So the D brain doesn't stay flat anymore. It can oscillate. So. Yeah. That would be a whole course in itself, the physics of deep brains. In fact, there is a whole book about it by Clifford Johnson. But before we take a break, let's actually go back to our business. At least I got excited with all this gauge group story and all this thing, but let's concentrate on what we want. Otherwise, we will not get there. Okay? So what do we want? Let's start our journey towards physical compactifications. What do I mean by that? Well, remember our goal. Four-dimensional theory with how many supercharges? 16 looks very exciting, but we don't live in a 16 supercharged world. We might live in. Okay, that's our goal for today. No, of course not. No, I mean, it's like you would say, oh, it's stupid to think about a theory that has an SU2 gauge symmetry. Because we don't see an SU. Do you see an SU2 gauge symmetry around you? I don't see it. But we believe it's there. We see the massive W bosons, right? When we perform experiments, we see evidence that there is actually an unbroken SU2 gauge symmetry at high energies, right? So the fact that we don't see it now doesn't mean that it's not there at high energies, because it could be a broken symmetry, right? We know that the idea of broken symmetry has been very successful, right? So likewise, having n equals 1 supersymmetry has a good chance of being something that can solve many problems, okay? Theoretically, it solves many problems, and that's why we believe that it might be there. There might be some signal that there are superparticles at colliders. And that's what I declared at the beginning of the lecture, that from the beginning of the lecture until the end, we were all the big number one fans of what? The minimal supersymmetric standard model, which you probably studied with Peskin. No, you didn't do it with Peskin, right? But you did it with Veronica.
Yeah.
Some of you. In any case, that was my assumption. And that's what we want to do, okay? I think it's actually, I think this is a good point, this is a good moment to say, right? We shouldn't lose perspective of what we're doing. You would say, we want something that has three families of quarks and leptons, no supersymmetry, theta cabivo, the right value, this and that and that. Okay, that's true, we want all that. But remember, the problem we decided to attack was the most difficult problem human mind has ever tried to achieve, which is to quantize gravity, right? And we have succeeded, okay? We succeeded in finding a theory that is mathematically consistent, it quantizes gravity. Of course, up to now, we haven't found, or I haven't told you anything about getting to something that looks like the real world, but people have succeeded in doing that, okay? They haven't found precisely what we see or what we experience, but it doesn't mean that it's not there. So we should always keep the perspective of what people have achieved and what people are still left, the things that are still left to do, okay? Okay. So, but up to this point in time, we are very, very far away from our goal, okay? Because we only have type 2A and type 2B string theories, which have 32 supercharges. And we know that if we just do the simple-minded thing of going to four dimensions in a manifold that looks like this, where this T6 is nothing but the product of many S1s. So we do Kaluza-Klein 6 times. So you're all experts in doing Kaluza-Klein once. You did it with Ruth Gregory. You can do it six times, and then you go down to four dimensions. You can make the extra dimensions very, very small so that they cannot be detected. So that would be fine. So that's not a problem. But the problem is that you will be left with 32 supercharges in four dimensions. And the reason is that a torus, locally, is flat, okay? So a torus doesn't have curvature. So these 32 supercharges are happily living there in this whole space, and they are preserved all the way down to four dimensions. So we will end up with a theory we don't like. Now, what's next? Well, the natural next step is to assume that we will go down to four dimensions by putting here some general six-dimensional manifold which is a solution of the equations of motion of our 10-dimensional supergravity. Yeah, well, if you do that, then you will be in trouble because you will break all supersymmetries. You would say, well, that's not bad. That's what we want, right? We want to break all supersymmetries. But if you do that, the original solution you found is not a valid solution of your string theory because nobody tells you that quantum corrections will not modify that solution. And therefore, you cannot trust that solution, okay? So that's a technical problem. But that technical problem is solved by our goal. Our goal is find a way of compactifying the theory in such a way that four supercharges survive. And that would be enough to keep the to tame the quantum corrections and trust our compactification to four dimensions. Okay? So what are unbroken SUSYs? Okay? So unbroken SUSYs are supersymmetric transformations that leave our choice of background invariant. Okay? So what do I mean by that? Well, our choice of background is like the vacuum on which we're choosing to to expand our string theory. Now, when you say that you have a symmetry means that you have a charge that annihilates the vacuum. That's when you say that your vacuum has that symmetry, right? That's the usual quantum field theory way of saying that you have a symmetry, is and that your vacuum doesn't break the symmetry. Now, the analog statement is that when you apply a SUSY transformation, the background or the solution of the equations of motion that you found will be invariant. Okay? But what is a solution of the equations of motion? Well, you take all bosonic fields. Well, first, take all fermionic fields to zero. Okay? A microscopic background, we don't see stars that are fermions, that are just that carry a big fermion number anywhere. So we only see bosonic excitations at microscopic distances. So we will take the solution we're going to find, we'll set all fermionic fields to zero. Once we do that, we solve the equations of motion only for the bosonic fields. Well, what are the bosonic fields? Well, you know very well, depending on the theory, well, for any of the two theories, we have the dilaton, we have the B field, the graviton, and we also have the Ramon-Ramon gauge fields. Okay? So you find the equations of motions, which we have written down, or we have written the Lagrangian for them, and try to find solutions to these equations. Now, what's the next step? The next step is to make sure that there are some supersymmetries that leave the background invariant. Well, how do you do that? You say, well, if I have some supersymmetric transformation on the bosonic fields, remember, the supersymmetric transformation of a bosonic field gives you what? What would it give you? A fermion. But we have set all fermions to zero, so that's great. So this is zero automatically on our solution. But that's not the whole story, right? We want to know that you apply a supersymmetric transformation and you get that the background stays invariant. So you not only have to check the bosonic fields, but you also have to check the fermionic fields. But this gives bosons. But the bosons are not set to zero. They are set to whatever solution of the equations of motion we found. So this is not zero. So setting this to zero is a requirement to have unbroken SUSY. requirement for unbroken SUSY is that the variation of fermionic fields happens to be zero. Now let's look at the variation of one of the very important fields that we have, which is the gravitino. Okay? What could this variation be? Well, we know what the variation has to be. We just have to work it out from the supersymmetric, from ensuring that the Lagrangian was supersymmetric. And it turns out to be the covariant derivative of the supersymmetric variation spinner. So our supersymmetry is parameterized by a spinner, by a fermionic guy, right, called epsilon. And this is what we find for the supersymmetric variation of the fermionic field of the Gugino, of the gravitino. Now we want this variation to be zero. And this is the equation we have to impose. Okay? So when you take your course on supergravity, all you're going to be doing, basically, will be solving these equations. These equations are so constraining that they actually imply the solution to all the other equations of motion. It's quite surprising. It's quite surprising that that happens. I know that this feels like holding your breath, but just hold your breath for 2 more minutes, and you will see that this will pay off.
Is it more complicated than that?
What's that? That looks fermionic.
Well, it looks very simple because I have turned off all the fields, all the fluxes.
But that looks fermionic. The thing, so Chi was a fermion, but under a SUSY variation, you should get something bosonic on the right hand side, shouldn't you?
Sorry.
Or is something involving bosons?
Well, the bosons are inside here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The object itself is fermionic.
Yeah, no, well, this is correct, right? Yeah, this. Well, when you have the variation, say, of something like this, right? Mm-hmm. What do you get? Say when you have pi and psi. What is the variation of this?
That's true. Sorry, I'm confused now.
Yeah. It was, yeah. Okay. Now, why is this so powerful? Well, the reason is the following. It's not that. First of all, if you take the commutator of 2 covariant derivatives, the failure of the commutator to vanish is measured by what? Do you remember? Yeah, by the curvature, but the curvature is measured by the Riemann tensor, right? Now, of course, these guys will depend on the representation, on the object you act here, right? So we want to act we can do it in general. Yeah. We want to act on our spinner. Now this turns out, of course, these indices will act funny on this guy, so we have to compensate with them with a gamma matrix. Now these gamma matrices also look funny because they should not carry these indices, which are space-time indices. They should carry tangent space indices. But you can translate between the gamma matrices, the usual ones with tangent space indices, and the other ones with the Willebrand, okay? And remember, the definition of this was anti-symmetric in P and Q. So this is what it is. Now, under that condition, this side vanishes. Okay? Obviously, because any covariant derivative acting on our spinner should vanish. And from here, if you contract with another gamma matrix, you can find that this is zero implies that the manifold must be Ricci flat. Okay? Quite amusingly, just from that condition, and remembering that this is true, you can deduce that the manifold has to be Ricci flat. Now, remember, we wanted to split our manifold as 1, 3 times N6. Okay? So let's call the coordinates here x and the coordinates here y. And split our spinner into two pieces that depend on x and y. Okay? We can split that because these two coordinates don't talk to each other. Now, applying the same logic, but just to the internal directions of this N6, we will conclude that N6 has to be Ricci flat. So that's the first condition. N6 has to be Ricci flat. Okay? I hope that that starts to ring a bell. It's a six-dimensional manifold that must be Ricci flat. Is that enough to ensure that there is a spinner that survives the compactification? Not yet. This is a consistency condition, but it's not enough. We actually have to impose some condition on the holonomy of this N6. So what is the most general holonomy group of N6 of any six-dimensional manifold? If you take a random six-dimensional manifold, what would be the holonomy group? Very good. This is for a general guy. Now, if that's true, then if you take your spinner, eta, in the internal manifold, it will not be covariantly conserved, right? Because if it was covariantly conserved, when you go around a curve, it will go back to itself. But if it's SO6, that will mix this guy completely. So it will not be invariant. Okay? So that would mean that no supersymmetries will be preserved. But SO6, remember the Dynkin diagram of SO6 was something like this, right? Well, this looks very much like this Dynkin diagram. It's in fact the same Dynkin diagram. And this Dynkin diagram was the Dynkin diagram for what? For SU4. Now I hope you know why we were doing all these things during the first week. We have SU4. Very good. Now the spinner of SO6, the general spinner of SO6, how many components do we have there? Well, we have 8 components in the general spinner of SO6. So in principle, this guy could be an 8-dimensional object. But it's not quite true. We know we can have vile spinners, positive and negative chirality spinners, and they are 4-dimensional. What are these representations with respect to SU4? Well, they turn out to be the fundamental and the anti-fundamental representations of SU4. Well, that looks very good. But still, if we pretend that this guy is a vile spinner, he will still transform under a holonomy, so it will not be preserved. Okay? But now imagine that you impose the following. Impose that you only choose M6 with a holonomy group which is SU3. Out of the possible SU4, you only want SU3 and only SU3. Okay? Which is a subgroup of the possible holonomy group. So the holonomy group, you impose it by hand. You want to compactify on a manifold that has holonomy SU3. Okay? If you do that, and you take, say, the right-handed spinner from Peskin or from Veronica, you should know that the 4 in SU4, when you did it with SU5, I guess, but in this case, the 4 of SU4 under SU3 inside SU4 breaks as a 3 plus 1. as a fundamental, this is under SU3. So this is a scalar. What does it mean being a scalar? Come on, you don't ask for a break. Yes, we will take a break, but just one more minute. I'm about to say that this guy, being a scalar means that it's invariant, right? Being invariant means that it's covariantly constant, okay? So there is precisely one guy. If we do all this, there is precisely one of these guys, just one, that will be covariantly constant and therefore preserved under the compactification. So this will be our unbroken SUSE. So for every SUSE that we had in 10 dimensions, okay, there will just be this guy that survives. Okay. Well, the last thing I want to say is that out of these components that you get from the guy that survived, guess what? You can construct a 1,1 tensor. Well, you can construct, you can construct a tensor. 1,1 in the sense that it's a form and a vector. Do you remember? The J was a form and a vector that satisfies as J squared is equal to minus 1. And not only that, the fact that this is covariantly constant means that this guy is covariantly constant. And remember that when we had this J covariantly constant meant that we had a, this J was an almost complex structure. And if the almost complex structure could be integrated over the whole manifold, meaning that it's covariantly constant, we got a complex manifold. So we have a complex manifold. Three-dimensional complex manifold, six real-dimensional, which has SU3 holonomy, okay, and it's redshift flat. And moreover, you can actually show that also the Kähler form happens to be closed. So it's also Kähler. And therefore, the compactification has to be a Calabi-Yau manifold, which is the thing that we did on Monday, okay? So let's take a break. Sorry about this. I mean, but,
5 minutes break.
Yeah, 5 minutes break. Yeah. No, you were all holding your breath. We will